is arguably the most important person in the biblical story before Jesus Christ. You could debate that. You could throw in Moses if you want, or David. I'm not going to get into a debate about that. All right? So we're going to talk about Abraham. When I asked that question, the answer was sitting on the screen there. Huh? Okay. Good. So Genesis 12 through 23, God chooses a man of faith through whom to bring the Messiah. And then the rest of Genesis is God's creating a people. From that man, he's creating a people. Okay? Especially with Jacob and the 12 tribes. Okay. So Abraham then is the chief human figure, arguably in the Old Testament. And we talked about that. And then, so we're going to talk about the promises, right? God gave these promises to Abraham. Genesis 12:2, he says, I'll make you into a great nation. Genesis 12:3 says, all nations will be, not just your nation, right? But all nations will be blessed through you, which kind of connects with Kenny's class right there in Genesis 12:3. All nations. The Jews didn't get it, but that's what Jesus said. That's what God said. And then in Genesis 13:15, he says, I will give you this land. Genesis 15:4-5, I will give you a son, and your offspring will be like the stars in the sky and the sands and the sea and all those things. And in Genesis 17:6, God says, kings will come from you. Kings will come from you. And God promised Abraham in chapter 12, again in chapter 15, again in chapter 17, and again in chapter 22. Four different times God described the promises to Abraham. So why did God do these things for Abraham? Was it because of his righteousness? No, it was because of his faith. Noah, it was his righteousness. But with Abraham, it was his faith. Romans 4:3, Abraham believed God, and it was credited to him as righteousness. What did he believe? Go right there to Romans chapter 4. He did not waver in unbelief, but he believed in the promises. He believed when God says it's going to happen, it's going to happen. Romans 4:20. Romans 4:20. It says, yet he did not waver through unbelief regarding what? Verse 20, you're not there yet. It's okay. You're getting there though. Romans 4 verse 20. Yet he did not waver through unbelief regarding promises of God. So the question is, do you believe God's promises? Because if you do, you will act on those promises. All right. And then you got Abraham. He's got some children. All right. There's the different promises. I should have gone to the slide. My apologies for not getting there. All right. And then he goes on a bit of a journey there. Interesting. He goes with his father and Lot and others from Ur to Haran. And at that point, he's not completely rejected the polytheism of his father. It's only when he leaves Haran. It leaves everything behind and begins to wander for the rest of his life, comes down to Shechem, then Beersheba, and he has this kind of embarrassing trip into Egypt where he kind of doesn't admit that he's married to Sarah. That's not so great. By the way, he said she was his sister. She was his half-sister, so it was one of those things where he kind of just revealed part of the truth. Ends up back at Beersheba. All right. So, I could get into the little Melchizedek thing, which is awesome, fantastic, and amazing, but that's too diving into the details. So skip all that really cool stuff about Melchizedek. Then we'll talk about Hagar, Sarah, Ishmael, and Isaac. So Isaac has two sons, right? Abraham has two sons, Ishmael and Isaac. Right, yeah. Isaac also had two sons, right? Jacob and Esau. And it's not an accident that there's two sons in both cases. Not an accident at all, because this is all foreshadowing. It's so cool how actual history is foreshadowing in beautiful, amazing ways. So he has two sons, and who's going to be the special chosen son, obviously? The firstborn.
Esau.
Esau. Or Ishmael. And if you were to ask a Jew, which are you? Are you Ishmael or Isaac? What would they say? They'd say, we're Isaac. But that's not true because they're Ishmael. Because like Jesus said, anyone who sins is a slave to sin. And he said to the Jews, you're all a bunch of slaves. He said, you're children of Ishmael. By the way, they could become children of Isaac. How? By repenting and being baptized. That's correct. But basically, by becoming children of promise. By faith. By faith. So what you said is correct, but probably by faith. By walking in the footsteps of Abraham. Correct? And by the way, this is right there. It's in Galatians chapter 4, verse 21. Galatians 4, 21. Let's get over there. Tell me, you who want to be under the law, are you not aware of what the law says? For it is written that Abraham had two sons, one by the slave woman, that's Hagar, right? And the other by the free woman, which would be Sarai. His son by the slave woman was born according to the flesh, but his son by the free woman was born as the result of a divine promise. Now, how much faith does it take to produce a Jewish child? It doesn't take any. You know, Mama Jew, Papa Jew, fill in the details. You got a baby Jew, all right? No faith involved. So only through faith do we become children of Isaac. And look at this, verse 24. In case you think I'm stretching the point to take these things figuratively, look what Paul says. He says, these things can be taken figuratively. So, phew, thank you. The women represent two covenants. So which covenant is Hagar then? The women represent two covenants. So which covenant does Hagar represent? The old covenant. Hagar represents Mount Sinai, whose children are slaves. Right? The one covenant is from Mount Sinai and bears children who are to be slaves. This is Hagar. Now, Hagar stands for Mount Sinai in Arabia. It corresponds to the present city of Jerusalem. All right? Got it? Because she is in slavery with children. But Jerusalem that is above is free. She is our mother. That's Sarah. For it is written, be glad, barren woman. Again, Sarah, you who never bore a child, shout for joy and cry aloud, you who are never in labor, because more of the children are the children of the desolate woman, that's Sarah, than of her who had a husband, which would be Hagar. Although Sarah had a husband, but she didn't have children. Now you brothers and sisters like Isaac are children of promise. And he's speaking to mainly Gentiles there in Rome, in Galatia, excuse me. At that time, the son born according to the flesh persecuted the son born by the power of the Spirit. So Ishmael persecuted Isaac, and when the church, Isaac was born, Ishmael, the Jews, persecuted the church. All figurative. But what did the scripture say? Get rid of the slave woman and her son. So God says, destroy Jerusalem in AD 70, scattering the Jews who would not accept by faith the promise of God, all fulfilled historically, sort of interesting. All right, and then there's Genesis 22, 1 through 6. And to me, Genesis 22 is kind of the height. It's the epitome. It's the highlight. It's the high point of the book of Genesis. And that, of course, is when Abraham goes to Mount Moriah, correct? So let's go to Genesis 22, verses 1 through 6. Let me see what's happening here. All right, yes, got that. Yeah, Genesis 22, it says 2 through 24. I'm going to start in verse 1. Genesis 22. Sorry about that. Let me get there.
Yeah.
Sometime later, God tested Abraham. He said to him, Abraham, here I am, he replied. God said, take your son, your only son whom you love. So here's some great little prefiguring. In this story, who is Abraham? God. And who is Isaac? Jesus. Right? Take your only son, Isaac, whom you love, and go to the region of Moriah. It's interesting because in 1 Chronicles 3, we learned that Moriah is where the temple is built. In other words, basically, Jesus was killed on the same mountain where Isaac offered his one and only son. That's 2 Chronicles 3, verse 1. All right? Anyway, early the next morning, verse 3, Abraham got up and he loaded his donkey, took with him two of his servants and his son Isaac. When he had cut enough wood for the burnt offering, he set out for the place God had told him. On the third day, wait a minute, isn't it 1 Corinthians 15:4, where Paul says, according to the scriptures, the Messiah must die. Got that one. Isaiah 53, Psalm 22. But he also said that the Messiah will be raised from the dead on the third day, according to the scriptures. Where's that prophecy? It's in Genesis 22. In fact, if you go to Hebrews 11:18, he says, figuratively, Abraham received his son back from the dead on the third day. Actually, the prophecy of being saved from death and brought back from the death on the third day is found in the book of Esther, who basically said, yes, I will give my life to save the Jews. She goes in to visit the king on the third day. She receives her life back. And then how about Jonah, who willingly offered his life to save the Gentiles? And he died. I believe he died in that fish. That's my opinion. I believe he died in that fish. And he was raised again on the third day. But I like this one here. All right, the idea that the Messiah, the one and only son who would give his life, would be, die and come back from the dead on the third day. Let's read on, though. So on the third day, Abraham looked up and he saw the place in the distance. He said to his servants, stay here with the donkey while I and the boy go over there. We'll worship and then we will come back to you. Abraham took the wood for the burnt offering and he placed it on his son Isaac. So Isaac's going up the mountain carrying the wood that was going to be used for his own sacrifice up the same mountain that Jesus carried the wood up the same mountain that was going to be used for his sacrifice. And so we see that when Jesus said in Matthew 5:17 that he came not to destroy the law and the prophets, but to fulfill them, we see that brought out very truly here. And it goes on. But in Genesis 22:16, look at the result. Look at the result of this incredible act of faith. I like what it says in Hebrews 11, I think it's 17. Abraham reasoned that God would raise his son from the dead. God didn't tell him, I'll raise your son from the dead. God said, kill him. And Abraham had said, well, the promise and the command are in direct opposition. The promise says, through your son, all nations will be blessed. And the command says, kill him. And how can those both be true? Abraham was so fully believing the promises, he persuaded himself, he reasoned himself into the only possible conclusion, which is, I guess God's going to raise him from the dead. In that case, technically, he was wrong. Right? Technically, he was wrong. But figuratively, he was right. So, verse 16. And starting in verse 15, the angel of the Lord called to Abraham from heaven a second time, and he said, I swear by myself, declares the Lord, that because you have done this and have not withheld your son, your only son, I will surely bless you. I will make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky, the sand in the seashore. Your descendants will take possession of the cities of their enemies. And through your offspring, that is through Jesus Christ, the great, 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 etc., grandchild of Abraham. And through your offspring, all the nations on earth will be blessed because you have obeyed me. So there you go. That's kind of sort of the summary of what Abraham is all about. Okay? Let's see. A little archaeological side trip. Let's do a little short archaeological side trip. This is Haran. Do I show Ur? I don't show Ur. Okay, this is Haran. If you go to Mesopotamia, you can dig, you can see where Ur was. Ur was south of Babylon. It was farther south. You can see it was the largest and most prosperous city in Mesopotamia in roughly 2000 BC. All right. And then Abraham travels from Ur to Haran. This is the site of the city of Haran, which was destroyed roughly 1800 BC. Okay. Haran was destroyed in 1800 BC. The enemies of the reliability of the scriptures will point out that this is all a big story. You know, that the idea of Abraham is a pure invention, historical fiction invented, you know, 1,000 years later by a bunch of Jews trying to make their little children obey them and do what they say or whatever. Well, if that's true, if Genesis was written in 800 BC, then this city had not even existed for 1,000 years. 1,000 years. All right. And then you go to the Ebla tablets, the city of Ebla in what would be northeast Syria today, tens of thousands of tablets. Some of the names mentioned in the Ebla tablets include, let me see, Nahor, all right, Terug, Abraham, and Sarah. All four names are found in these tablets. By the way, these are not the biblical characters. It's just because Abram was a common name. Where? In Mesopotamia, roughly 2000 BC. Oh, and Terug. Does anybody name their kid Terug? Did anybody in Palestine 500 BC name their kid Terug? Nobody did. So these names are the names of people that were living around 2000 BC in Mesopotamia, not in Egypt. If Moses had written Genesis, he would have had to dig up these names. I don't know how he would have dug them up. Maybe because he's inspired or something like that. All right, so we have some archaeological evidence. By the way, we're never going to find evidence of Abraham directly. What kind of house did Abraham live in? He lived in a tent. So you're not going to discover his remains. That's ridiculous. But it's interesting because the historical and cultural background of the book of Genesis is Mesopotamia, roughly 2000 BC. That's just fact. All right, and there's other things. For example, there's the story about Laban. You know how Laban chased down Jacob? You know, Jacob, he takes his not-so-beautiful daughter, and then he takes his beautiful daughter, and he takes all the stuff, and the cattle, and the sheep, and the goats, and the camels, he takes off. And Laban chases him down to get what? To get his daughter back? No. To get the household gods. Right? You read the story there. It's in Genesis 31. Well, in the Nuzi tablets, that's not the N-E-W-S-Y, the N-U-Z-I, another city, not the Ebla tablets, the city of Nuzi, they found an inscription that says, whoever possesses the household gods, the teraphim, inherits the family property. Okay. So again, if you look at local cultural information in Mesopotamia from roughly 2000 BC, then the book of Genesis, specifically Genesis 12 through 50, makes sense. In the other cultural context, it really doesn't. So that tells me that the material in Genesis, although it was put in its final form probably sometime after 1000 BC, honestly, it contains actual ancient material from the Near East, from the Middle East, from 2000 BC. And then there's the five cities, okay? Genesis 14:2. So what happens is, Chedorlaomer, the Elamite king, is fighting against the five city alliance of, the five king alliance there in the Dead Sea. Alright? And then Chedorlaomer defeats the five cities of Sodom, and Levi comes, Abraham's nephew, my brain's not working. Lot, thank you. So Abraham goes and gets Lot's stuff back and defeats Chedorlaomer and all that sort of stuff. And if you go to the Dead Sea, I mean, there's a reason they call it the Dead Sea. I mean, it is one of the most desolate places in the entire earth. It's like 1,200 feet below sea level. It's like 120 degrees on a good day. I mean, it's ridiculously hot. It's horrible. And in fact, for many, many years, archaeologists didn't even bother to even try to do archaeological digs around the Dead Sea. Waste of time. But then in the 1970s, they began to look, and guess how many cities they found? Five. All destroyed roughly 2000 BC. Now, in the biblical story, Abraham's up there in the Judean hill saying, this is the stinky land, but Abraham, you get the good land down there by the Dead Sea. Really? Well, what they discovered was extensive irrigation. By the way, even 2000 BC, it was a dry area. It was very dry, but they had these wadis, which at that time flowed 12 months out of the year. And it's kind of like if you go to the Imperial Valley today. Total desert and green as anything because of the irrigation. So again, I see some reason to think that maybe this is historical material. In fact, it's historical material from Mesopotamia from roughly 2000 BC. Another one is the Hittites, right? By the way, the largest of the five, this one almost certainly is Sodom. Baba Dra. I think I might have a picture of the ruins. There are some of the ruins from Sodom. It's an actual place. Okay, then there's the Hittites. The Hittites mentioned something like 120 times in the Old Testament. Up until in the 19th century, archaeologists and the critics of the Bible and biblical history in general said the Hittites, Hivites, Perizzites, Jebusites, Canaanites, Gershonites, and all those. Just, you know, whatever. You know, obviously not real. And then they discover the city of Hattusha. There are the ruins of Hattusha, a large city, which was the main city of a massive empire that covered almost all of what we'd call Turkey today. And it was the chief rival to the Assyrians and to the Egyptians in roughly 1600 BC. So, I don't know. I believe probably the Hittites are real people. There's the gates to the city of Hattusha. In fact, you can even study the Hittite language. You can get a major in Hittite studies. So, I believe in the Hittites. Now, can I prove the Gershonites yet? I don't know. I believe in the Gershonites, the Jebusites, the Amalekites, and all those other ites. So, just a brief little thing. There's the extent of the Hittite Empire at its greatest around 1300 BC. Yeah, I believe in Hittites. There you go. All right, now we go to Sodom and Gomorrah. Sodom and Gomorrah, a foreshadow of judgment, but also a foreshadow of salvation. And like I believe I already said, judgment is ever present in the Old Testament, but every time I see judgment discussed, I also see the rainbow of salvation. It's always there. And that's true even in the story of Sodom and Gomorrah. So Sodom is a type of essentially rebellion and sin. And by the way, in Ezekiel, I believe it's chapter 14, he says the chief sin of the Sodomites was their lack of social justice and their lack of care for poor and for others. That's an interesting thing to notice if you read about Sodom in Ezekiel. And in 2 Peter 2, God tells us what happened to Sodom is a foreshadow of what will happen to those who sin. So how did God feel about the people of Sodom? Well, number one, he was willing to give his one and only son in order to save them. But also, he does not appreciate their sin. In fact, he's going to destroy them. And so God calls Lot out of the city, right? So the angels come to Lot and they say, Lot, you need to get out of that city right now. And Lot's there, yeah, let's escape, man. What's Lot doing in Sodom? And he's a righteous man, 2 Peter 2. What's he doing in Sodom anyway? You know what I'm saying? So Lot says, yeah, let's go. And no, it's not quite like that. Sodom's, you know, Lot said, yeah, it's not that bad. I mean, sure, there's a few things going on here in Sodom, but, you know, spend the night, it'll be okay, you know. And those angels, they practically had to drag him out of that city. So Lot represents those who make it just barely. All right, and there's a lot. You're living in Sodom. Whether it's in Orange County, up here, down there in San Diego, you're living in Sodom, and you're going to have to maybe drag a few people out. But interestingly, what about Lot's wife? She, too, is a foreshadow. You know, the shortest verse in the New Testament, in the Bible, is in John 11, right? Jesus wept. You know the second shortest verse in the Bible? It's actually Luke 17:32, where Jesus says, "Remember Lot's wife." Because who is she? A foreshadow. She's your friend, right? You know who that is. That's the person who put their hand to the plow and looked back. So the message of Genesis 17 is do not look back, right? And there's this little tiny detail in Genesis 23 you might forget. And remember God said to Abraham, all this land will be yours. Do I have a, I think, I don't know if I can't remember if I have a slide on this. Yeah. God says the entire, every place you put your feet lands will be your place, right? But all he gave him was a cave and a field outside that cave in Machpelah. And like we read in Hebrews 12, these people, they didn't receive the promise. They saw the promise from a distance. So what did Abraham get? A cave and a little field out in front. But you know what? That's where Abraham was buried. That's where Isaac was buried. That's where Jacob was buried. And that's even where Joseph was buried. Joseph was buried in the cave in Machpelah. Because the cave in Machpelah is a symbolic of the future. During his lifetime, Abraham received only a postage stamp-sized partial fulfillment of the promise. And you can see in Hebrews 11:13, Abraham, he only could see from afar the promise that we have fully received. We have that promise. We have the Messiah. We have all these types, prefigures, and foreshadows fulfilled for us. How can we fail to have faith? All right, but going on, I'm going to skip Isaac. Because Isaac, he's kind of a weak figure, really. He did have the covenant renewed. God gave the same promise to Isaac that he gave to Abraham. But Isaac is, he's kind of a weak figure compared to, say, Jacob. All right? So we'll go on to Jacob. Because the story of Jacob is the story of Gentile and Jew. Because as Ishmael goes, so goes Esau. And as Isaac goes, so goes Jacob, right? So Esau then represents Israel, the natural born, the natural firstborn, who should have received the inheritance. But why did they not receive the inheritance? Because of lack of faith. It's always been about faith. And we learned that through Abraham, but we certainly also learn it through Jacob and Esau. You think Jacob was a person of faith? He didn't start out so great, but actually if you look at the end, he's grabbing that angel and he's wrestling with that angel and he says, I am not going to let go until you give me that promise. Jacob ended up a man of great faith. He was a lousy person of faith. But then again, Abraham wasn't so awesome at the beginning either, was he? You know? So Esau, like Ishmael, represents the old covenant, represents slavery. The firstborn should have been favored, but God always chooses the unfavored one. He always, consistently does that. Who is Jacob? He's us. He's the church. He's the new covenant. God is telling us you'll set up a new covenant. In Romans 9, 10 through 13, what's it say? Jacob I loved, Esau I hated. In Malachi 3, 1, or is it 1, 3? Malachi 1, 3. Jacob I loved, Esau I hated. Did God hate Esau? Did God hate the Jews? No. Right? He blessed Esau. Esau became the father of Edom. And he was extremely wealthy. And when God said to Abraham, you would be the father of many nations, that's true. All right? The Moabites, the Edomites, the Arabs, right? Through Ishmael. The Arabs come, at least according to the Bible, from Ishmael. All right? God didn't hate Esau, but he chose. He deliberately chose the younger son. He chose Isaac. He chose Jacob to tell us something. You know, they were fighting in the womb, right? They're like, you know, poor Rebecca, you know. I mean, it's bad enough. I think we have possibly a pregnant mom here today. Possibly. All right. You never want to say that. You don't want to assume unless you know it for an absolute fact, right? Don't ever make that mistake, guys. Don't ever make that mistake of saying, are you pregnant? Don't ever do that. And I don't care how certain you are. Just don't do it. There's nothing to be gained from asking that question. Absolutely nothing. Because even if she is pregnant, she'll probably still be offended that you asked her. So just don't even ask her. Just let that one go. Okay? But really, the story of Esau and Jacob is the story of God choosing us. Yes, even over the Jews. And that's kind of why Paul's getting pretty exercised there in Romans 9. He's saying, just like God's upset with the Jews in Malachi 1. And what's going on is, see, in Malachi 1, I mean, the Jews, they had faith in God. They believed he could bless them, but because he wasn't blessing them right away, they were not faithful to God. All right? And so we have that. Did God hate Esau? No. But God chooses whom he chooses. All right? And let me just read a couple of blurbs here. Genesis 25. Genesis 25, verse 21 through 24. All right? Here we go. Isaac prayed to the Lord on behalf of his wife. That Isaac did some good things. Did you guys have a better prayer time in this morning than maybe the morning before? I hope so. I did. Thank you, Joe, and especially Annie. I was challenged by Joe, but honestly, Annie kind of, she got me going there. Appreciate that. All right. Yeah. All right. Isaac prayed to the Lord on behalf of his wife because she was childless. And by the way, this whole childless mother giving birth to a child of promise, I mean, that theme is again and again and again and again. It's right down even to Jesus, to Mary's, her cousin, I guess, right? Okay. Anyway, the Lord answered his prayer and his wife Rebecca became pregnant. The babies jostled each other within here. And they're still doing it even today. Even today, those babies are jostling with each other. All right. So why is this happening to me? So she went to inquire the Lord. The Lord said to her, two nations are in your womb. Two peoples from within you will be separated. That's Edom and the Jews. One people will be stronger than the other, and the older will serve the younger. And God uses that in Romans as an example of, yes, even the Jews will serve the Gentiles. Right? When the time came for her to give birth, there were two twin boys in her womb. The first came out was red, and his whole body was like a hairy garment. He named him Esau. So there you go. Two nations are in your womb. We see a foreshadowing of the relationship between Israel and Edom, and also a foreshadowing of the relationship between Jewish Christians who were jealous of the Gentile Christians. And as usual, it just seems to always happen, the older keeps serving the younger. This historical foreshadow is carried throughout the Bible. In even the symbolism of Jacob grasping the heel of Esau. Pretty cool stuff. And then Esau, of course, sells his birthright. Correct? For what? Bowl of lentil stew. All right, and in Hebrews 12:16, he says, don't let that happen to you. What about Joseph? Joseph, we need to talk about Joseph more than we do. Joseph is incredible stuff. Because The story of Joseph is really the story of Jesus. Because Joseph was the chosen favorite son of his father, right? But what happened to Joseph? Well, you know, his brothers weren't so fired up about that, so they decided to kill him. Jesus comes, the chosen favorite only son, and his brothers, the Jews, say, we're going to get rid of this guy, right? So they decide to kill him, and somehow God intervenes. He stops that, and instead they sell him as a slave. And the approximate price of a slave at that time was 20 pieces of silver. I've heard it said in the Roman world the approximate price of a slave was 30 pieces of silver. Aha! And he gets sold as a slave into Egypt, because out of Egypt I called my son. Hosea 11:1, right? Out of Egypt I called my son. So Joseph, who's at the right hand of his father, ends up what? As a slave, where? In Egypt. And God calls him out of Egypt, but it took 430 years for it to actually happen. I'll get to that. But basically, God raised him up to the right hand of the king. He became the right hand of the king in Egypt. At the right hand of his father, slave in Egypt, right hand of the king. Who's that a picture of? That's Jesus. That's Jesus. And, you know, and he's got this dream of the 11 bushels of wheat bowing down to him, and 11 stars bowing down to him, and even the moon, you know, even his mother and father bowing down to him, they don't get too excited about that. But you know what? Like God said in Hosea 11:1, out of Egypt I called my son. And if you go to Genesis 50, verses 24 and 25, all right, if you go to Genesis 50, verse 24 and 25, Joseph says, all right, you're going to be brought down into slavery, but when you leave Egypt, take my bones. Take them back to the promised land. And then in Exodus 13, 19, 430 years later, when the Jews are leaving in haste, they're just, you know, they don't even have time to bake their bread. But you know what they remembered to do? They remembered to carry Joseph's bones out of Egypt. Because out of Egypt I called my son. Then in Joshua 24, verse 32, 40 years even further after that, finally, Joseph's bones were laid to rest at the cave of Machpelah. So he's the favorite son of Jacob. He tended sheep. I'm sure he was a pretty good shepherd. I don't know how good he was. All right. Out of jealousy, his brothers decide to kill him. Instead, they sell him as a slave. He's brought out of Egypt, although after he died, he was raised by God to become a prince from a very humble situation. He's a prefigure of the Messiah in that he saved Israel. He gave bread to the world. He received his son back from the dead. And many other things. So that's sort of cool. And then we have Genesis 49. All right, let me see. Genesis 49, sort of the summary. Tell them what you're going to tell them, then tell them, and tell them what you told them. That goes on here even in Genesis 49. All right, let's turn to Genesis 49 here. All right, we're going to finish Genesis. We're going to get as far as Exodus today. Great. I'm just going to read a little section here, verse 10. So basically, he makes prophecies. All right, this is Jacob, whose name has now been changed to Israel, right? Him who fights with God, right? Him who fights with God, Israel. All right, he gives prophecies about each of his 12 children. Now, who logically should be the one through whom the Messiah would come based on what you know so far? I would think Joseph, or maybe Benjamin, because after he lost Joseph, Benjamin became his favorite son. But we might not have picked Judah. All right, we might not have picked Judah. But starting in verse 8, Judah, your brothers will praise you. Your hand will be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's sons will bow down to you. You are a lion's cub, Judah. You return from the prey, my son. Like a lion, he crouches and lies down, like a lioness who dares to rouse him. The scepter will not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until he to whom it belongs shall come, and the obedience of the nations shall be his. And he will tether his donkey to a vine, his colt to the choicest branch. He will wash his garments in wine, his robes in the blood of grapes, etc. So there's a nice little prophecy about Jesus, who would be the son of Judah, the son of Jesse, the son of David, etc. Okay? So, I'm going to keep going here. All right, I've got another 15 minutes, correct? But any questions about the book of Genesis before I sort of launch into Exodus? Questions about Abraham, Joseph, Jacob? All right? So what about Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy? All right, so the rest of the Pentateuch. We're not going to finish the Pentateuch today. We'll finish Exodus today. And probably Leviticus, who knows, maybe even Numbers, we'll see. So the outline of these four books is, number one, God saves his people from slavery. The chief event after Genesis, the chief event of Genesis being Abraham's faith and God being, Abraham receiving the covenant of faith. The chief event in Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy clearly is God saving his people from slavery in Egypt. So a basic outline is God saves his people from slavery. God gives his people a law and a covenant. He protects his people in the wilderness, although he also disciplines them, and he's amazingly patient with them, and he brings his people into the promised land. This is it. This is the whole story. Really, at the end of Deuteronomy, the story is complete. Right? Of course, it's also complete at the end of Revelation, but at the end of Deuteronomy, it's also complete because they enter the promised land. Because slavery in Egypt is about us outside of Christ. What happens? We go through the water, right? We're baptized, us into Christ, them into Moses, and then we're wandering around in the promised land. Not in the promised land, we're wandering on in the wilderness. So if you want to understand Deuteronomy, Numbers, Leviticus, think of it this way. That's us. We're disciples, and God's trying to get us to be ready for the promised land. All right, so basically then, you could say the Bible starts in the garden and ends in the garden, but then the Pentateuch starts in the garden and ends in the garden. It's the same story. It's the same narrative. All right? But the last four books start where almost everybody you ever meet are right now, which is in slavery. All right? We were enslaved to sin. And God's people, and he loved his people. He would do anything to save his people. But they get caught up in slavery. So what does God do? He sends Jesus. Well, he sends Moses. But Moses is Jesus. In fact, that's what Matthew 2, 3, and 4 are all about. This whole beginning part of Matthew is God saying Jesus is the new Moses. He's the new Moses. In fact, even later on, in John 6... Moses gave you bread. Well, he didn't really give you bread, but I am the bread of life. I am the bread of life. So it's interesting because what you have is the story of a Jewish baby born into slavery, and this Gentile king has this crazy idea that a Jewish unidentified baby boy is going to replace him as king, right? That's Pharaoh. Who else is that? Herod, right. That's Pharaoh and Moses, and that's Herod and Jesus. Same thing. All right? But in both cases, God saves his son. All right? From being killed. And so Moses starts out the same way Jesus starts out. Of course, God saves Jesus from this wicked king who's jealous, who thinks he's going to be replaced by this Jewish child, as irrational as that may seem. So where does God send Jesus? He sends him to Egypt. Why? Hosea 11:1, because out of Egypt I called my son. Out of Egypt I called Moses. Out of Egypt I called Joseph. Out of Egypt I called Israel. Out of Egypt I called Jesus. And out of Egypt I called, you know, Chloe and Fadi and everybody in this room. God calls us all out of Egypt. All right, so the parallels here are striking, I would say. So God wants to save us from slavery. So what's he do? He sends a Savior. He sends a Savior. The parallels, again, between Moses and Jesus are pretty good. Because it's so amazing. There are two different Jews born into poverty, sent down essentially as a slave into Egypt, both of whom rise to be the right hand of the Pharaoh. Who's that? That's Joseph, but that's also Moses. Moses, this baby Jew, who Pharaoh is afraid is going to replace him, accidentally he raises him up to his right hand to be his adopted son. So we have Moses sitting there in the palace. He's got everything. He's got the best food. He's got the best clothing. He's got all the girls want to have a date with Moses. It's awesome. All right? Moses is at the right hand of his father. Jesus is at the right hand of his father. So what does Moses do? He leaves the palace to become a slave, to live amongst the slaves. Because you have to become like a slave to save the slaves. All right? Moses and Jesus. Jesus is the new Moses. All right? And so all this parallel is no accident. Moses had no idea, of course, obviously, none whatsoever. But that's sort of the point. Theme of Exodus. God saves his people from bondage. God will go to any length, other than forcing us, he'll go to any length for us to be saved from bondage to sin. Our theme verse of Exodus, Exodus 14, verse 13 and 14. Exodus 14, verse 13 and 14 says, Moses answered the people, "Do not be afraid. Stand firm, and you will see the deliverance the Lord will bring you today. The Egyptians you see today, you will never see again. The Lord will fight for you. You need only to be still and know that I am God." I know I'm kind of throwing that in there. Okay? What we need to do is not look at the outward appearance, but to be still. Because faith is belief in things that aren't seen. What you could see is we're slaves. He's king. He's got an army. We got nothing. Right? But what we have is God fighting on our side. And with God on our side, all the other stuff doesn't really matter a whole lot. All right? So we got the outline of Exodus here. I'm not going to go through any of these outlines here. This, you can read it and you can make your own outline. I'll do the simple outline. God saves Israel from Egyptian slavery. He gives them his law. He establishes his covenant. And he commands them to build his tabernacle. It's a very important point. He commands them to build his tabernacle, which is a place for him to dwell. All right? By the way, you know in the New Testament where it talks about the Passover, and it talks about the Day of Atonement. But sometimes it just calls it the festival. But it doesn't say which festival. More than once, it says they were in Jerusalem for the festival. Well, which festival is that? For like for us, when we say the holidays. Which, are we talking about the 4th of July? We're talking about Halloween? When we say the holidays, what do we mean? We mean Christmas. So when the Jews said the festival, which festival? Not Passover. See, I knew you're gonna say the wrong answer, but don't you appreciate Chloe at least having the boldness to say something? Wouldn't you rather be wrong than to just say nothing? Yeah. No. Next guess? Sabbath? That's not a festival, but maybe Day of Atonement? No. No, it's Tabernacles. It's Tabernacles. Because Tabernacles was a celebration of dwelling with God. This was the glory time. It's interesting. They're in the desert. They had nothing. But you know what? They had to rely on God. That's you as a baby Christian. Remember when you fully relied on God before you relied on all this other stuff? And maybe I'm exaggerating, but you know what I'm saying? So they got three tribes on the east, three tribes on the west, three tribes in the north, three tribes in the south, and they're dwelling with God. So that's important. I just got, oh, okay, I thought I had 5 more minutes, but I don't. Oh, it ended at 11:45? Oh, man, I stole time for you guys. Done. Done. Should have told me to stop 5 minutes earlier. Ah, you gave me too much. You were too generous. Thank you.
Thanks, John.
51 minutes.